Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hi, folks. Welcome to another episode of Film Study. This is Ken McKusick, and we're back for part two of the discussion of the offense in this last game against the Bengals. Great win. We talked a little bit in the first episode about how it might not have been as fun a discussion had that two-point conversion been good. Michael Crawford joining me here. How you doing, Michael?
Doing great, Ken. Thanks again for having me. Yeah, way less fun. Way less fun. You know, when you play on Thursday night, you get those mini buys. Just a miserable time in between this game and the Steelers game if the Bengals were able to get that two-point conversion, but they didn't. And so the vibe is totally different.
Yep. Yep. Lots of good things we talked about in the first episode. Where did the Ravens go? Did they make changes at the mini bye? Stevens at safety, we talked about a little bit. Should Wiggins be getting a bigger role? Do you sit Marcus Williams at this point after an additional breakdown in this game, or do you try and work your way through that? We talked a little bit about some packages, very simple package offerings that the Bengals show the Ravens offensively, which makes it easier for defensive packages, but a little bit of buddy system play. We talked about the pass rush and obviously a big game for the pass rush in this one that unfortunately the coverage unit did not really come through on the opportunity that was provided to him, or more accurately stated, the opportunity that was denied to Burrow on a lot of plays. So unfortunately that didn't work out as well. This time we're going to start a little differently. We're going to go to the mailbag first and talk about that, because I think we'll then hit on some of the things that we otherwise would talk about in the individual player discussion. So I'm going to just read you some questions, Michael. Please hit on these first with the answer, and maybe I'll have something to say on some of them. First one is from Bufudu, and this is a Reddit question. He says, early in Mahomes' career, the Chiefs got by with a top offense and a pretty poor but opportunistic defense. Do you think that same formula can work for the Ravens?
Yeah, I think that could be viable. Turnovers are a game changer, literal game changers. Mm-hmm. If the Ravens were, I mean, honestly, look, we'd like them not to be giving up as much as they've been giving up in terms of yardage and even points. So could it be, if it were a little bit less of that and they were able to kind of generate some more turnovers? I think, you know, what you just talked about, and for people who go back and listen to part one, it's kind of a good example, right, of what it could be. If you have that kind of pressure game, you're hoping it could possibly lead to more of those turnovers.
Oh, sure as hell, yeah.
Right? And if it did, then that's probably a very different game score-wise. So, yeah, could you live that way, right? It's kind of a live by the sword, die by the sword kind of thing. Like, yeah, you're going to give up plays and you're going to give up stuff, but you're getting these turnovers in bunches, and so it kind of helps you, it kind of saves you. Yeah, I think you could do it. I think their offense obviously is among the best, if not the best in the league right now. So, yeah, I think you could get by that way. I think I saw somebody earlier today say that, you know, the 2020, if you had the 2024 offense and the 2023 defense, it might be one of the best teams of all time.
There's no doubt in my mind, by the way, about that they would be the greatest team of all time. It's an unbelievable pairing of offense and defense that you just can't build in the cap era.
Yeah, it'd be ideal, but that wasn't the question. Could they do it that way? Sure. I think it would be viable, but that's a kind of a high variance way to play defense. And when you don't get those turnovers and you're still bad, that can come back to bite you.
Yeah. The Ravens when they've had high turnover defenses, they've typically been outstanding average yards and average play kind of defenses that could really slow the opponent down the field, either with dink and dunk passing or bedying the running game and making those offenses into high variance situations. And I just mean on a getting off the field on a series of downs basis, not necessarily getting turnovers. Yeah. But I would love for that to be true. I think this defense has to be a little bit better overall before I think adding, say, 20 or 30% more turnovers are really going to help them. Yeah. I mean, it's not like 20, 30% turnovers wouldn't help them at all. And it's not like a turnover in this last game wasn't really important to turning the game around. Obviously, Humphrey's forced fumble was the play of the game, I think, for the Ravens.
Yeah, critical. So, yeah, that's a prime example right there, right? Just how important that would be if they did have more of those going, even with the way that they're playing.
All right, got a double question here. Jay Gibbons, 69, says, do you feel the issues with the defense are mainly coaching or mainly failures by the players to execute? And Green 1010 asks a good question that goes along with that. Great question. How did they get so much worse? Is it largely the same? I mean, we were told it was basically going to be a continuation of scheme in a lot of ways with the word. That doesn't mean you do that, but you have institutional knowledge. And we saw the run game stay the same way between Roman and Malkin in a lot of ways, not exactly the same scheme for scheme, but the reliance on Patrick Ricard, for example, the reliance on counters, a lot of that institutional knowledge stayed. Why has it been so difficult for the Ravens defense to duplicate some of the things that they did with McDonald?
That's the $6 million question. And I started to do this a little bit earlier in the season. Like I'd mentioned to you off air, I'm not charting plays anymore. I'm sort of not doing deep dive analytical stuff or film analysis. Let me say that. I'm not analytical, please. That's definitely not me. Film analysis stuff like I used to. But there was something I saw earlier in the season. I don't know. It was a YouTube content creator who did it. And they were talking about how much disguise the Ravens did in their secondary and how that was really a big part of their problem, right?
Yep.
Too much rotation, too much post-snap rotation. Guys aren't getting into position because the disguise is so important to them that it's getting guys out of position. So I said, well, you know what? Let me go back and look at last year and 2022 just to see, you know, just rough, right? And let's do it, you know, real loose. Like I said, this isn't like a real planned out film analysis thing like it probably should have been if I was really trying to do it the right way. But let's look at some common opponents. Let's look at division opponents. Now, of course, again, different players, different, you know, we know their differences. But let me just try to look at some of this stuff and just try to get a feel for some trends. And again, if I was really doing it the right way, I'd be doing it, you know, I'd be charting it each play, down, distance, time in the game, formations, you know, opponent formations, that kind of thing, to really try to get, you know, as close to an apples to apples thing as I could. I didn't do it that way, but just to get some big picture trend feels. I didn't think it was wholly different. They were still showing a sort of a too high static shell, post-snap rotation, still doing a lot of 5 and 6 man pressures at time. Not a lot, not in terms of volume, but like when they pressure. Right. Same types of pressures. Right. They were still using in 22 and 23 as they're using this year. So I couldn't look at it. Obviously, there were some differences, but I didn't come away feeling like, oh, yeah, they're doing way more of this stuff this year. And that's what the problem is. I didn't come away feeling like that. I came away feeling like I don't think this is tremendously different structurally. So why is it so much worse? If that's actually the case, again, that's an assumption on my part because I didn't do a deep dive. But let's work from that assumption. Why is it so much worse? I think it's a combination of those things from the first question. Some of it's on the players, some of it's on the coaches. You know, I know sometimes those are not satisfying answers because people will now tell me what's the answer. A lot of times there isn't an answer with this. It's multiple things that are going on and it's happening on each individual play. I think I was telling Jonah Schaefer this. I was like, I feel pretty comfortable that I can look at the individual plays, these breakdown type plays, and come away with a general sense of what went wrong and even to some extent probably why it went wrong. What I can't do is tell you why that continues to happen.
Okay.
I can't figure it out.
I'll try and answer a small piece of this and just say that in looking at one particular thing, like is the pass rush the problem or is the secondary the problem? If you're looking at player contributions, to me, it's by far the secondary. The back seven are letting down a pass rush that has been weak when Jones is out, but otherwise been very good. And that's the part I cannot figure out is how breakdowns continue to happen on the back end. I mean, we haven't had this in years. You have to really go back to early 2000, 18 and 19 when this was happening with any kind of degree of frequency to the close. Think about that Cardinals game in 2019. Bunch of breakdowns in the secondary. Tony Jefferson involved in some of them. That's the last time I can remember them playing like one game like they did just here on Thursday night. And it's mind-boggling to a certain degree. I guess the Miami game from 22 would be another one where they allowed the big comeback, and there were some breakdowns in coverage certainly in that game. So I don't want to be myopic about it, but I do think it's much more on the back end than it's on the pass rush this year. And that's the part. I hope they can figure out a way to get that dealt with.
Yeah, me too.
All right. I've got another one here. My question center. This is from Unborn Bigfoot. Great type, great handle, by the way, there. my question centers around Washington. I don't know which Washington means. I guess he means Ardarius. Given the Mollett return and Williams' disappointment, his snap share felt very high last night. Maybe a Hamilton thing. Well, yeah, probably a Hamilton thing because he was the full-time strong safety after Hamilton went out. Can he play the Marcus Williams role at all, or is he strictly a slot at this point? Well, I think they've kind of made him strictly a strong safety at this point. They've got him back there next to Marcus Williams, who is the only center fielder that the team has. If the safety pairing is Kyle and Washington, with Marcus only coming in to play as the third, as a deep option, is that viable?
Possibly. You know, I've liked Ardarius going back to coming out of TCU. I definitely was kind of on the stump for him, even when he wasn't getting opportunities early on those first couple of years. But one thing that I've always kind of said about him, just my opinion, right, from my perspective, is he most effective when he's facing the ball, yeah. Right, when he's facing the quarterback. Not necessarily just coming downhill. We've seen him do that, right, in tackle situations, right? He definitely can come downhill, and even for a smaller guy, you know, he can make tackles. But even driving on throws, it's just better. When he's got to turn his back to the ball, not as consistent. And so if you are in the deep post and you're bailing out of there and you're getting depth and you've got everything in front of you, could I see that? Maybe, but I don't know. There's just something about that role that I'm not sure that they want him to be in that role consistently. Could he do it? I don't know. I think that you'd probably not be maximizing what he does best. I like the quickness. I like the twitchiness, especially in the slot closer to the line of scrimmage. You saw him a couple times in the game last night, matched up with Gesicki, and there's a huge height difference there.
Yep.
And he's still able to drive on Gesicki and break up passes, almost, you know, tip one and pick it, and you tip it to himself and almost pick it in one situation. So I just think that short area, underneath area, I just think that that's sort of where he's better. It's hard to find those true center fielders. Those guys are hard to find. And I never like to say what a player can't do because it's so absolute. Sal, you can't do this. Might not be great at it. Might not be able to do it consistently, but it's hard to say somebody can't do something. But I probably would. Well, again, I guess I'd be contradicting myself earlier because I said all options are on the table, but I don't know. It probably wouldn't be the way that I would go, but maybe you take a look at it if I stick to my all options are on the table mantra.
I think that he actually offers the Ravens more at slot than Mollett does. So I would love for them to go back to that. I thought he offers pass rusher, run defense. He's kind of like a mini version of Humphrey in some ways, in that he gives you a lot of physicality, certainly relative to his size. Kind of reminds me of Corey Ivey and some other smaller guys who've played the slot before here with the Ravens. You know, my original concern was going back to strong safety. It just wasn't going to be a good enough tackler at his size. Yeah. That we're going to miss some tackles. I don't think that's really borne out at all. I see him go after Ferguson in that Dallas game and Gesicki in this game. And those are guys who are just, almost a foot taller than him. And he's still able to deal with them in terms of coming downhill, knowing how to tackle them and being pretty good at it. But I do think it's a question of the Ravens have a need, and that dictates they play one way, and the Ravens have a player who who's probably best suited to be a different position. And these things are in conflict with Ardarius Washington. They need Ardarius Washington to play the back end because they don't have anyone else to do it. Yeah. They and they really don't want to use Hamilton there because they think they get even more with Hamilton up front than they do with Washington. So, you know, they're constantly saying, plus, now we don't even know when Hamilton will be back.
Yeah.
So, you know, now I think you're forced into a situation where if it's not going to be Ardarius Washington, then it's probably going to be another extreme solution, like moving Brandon Williams back there. I do not think Kane or Braid is the answer. So, you know, and again, I don't want to get into the game of saying what a player can't. I just, at least right now, let me say, I don't think either of those guys is the answer.
Yeah.
So you know, the Ravens have a fairly limited set of options available to them. I guess they could go out and get a street safety. The kind of guy that's available would be like, you know, DeAndre Houston Carson or somebody who the Ravens had on their practice squad for most of the year. He ended up playing a one snap or something with the Ravens, or very little. I think he might have been active for one game. And then he ends up being a starting safety for Houston in the playoff game we played next time, which just boggles the mind. But that's the kind of player you might end up with on the back end if you're really looking at the street to find a player at this time of year.
Yeah. And part of me initially would say, okay, well, can we do some things structurally? Can we maybe play more two high coverages and less post safety coverages, like one, you know, single high safety deep? But then, and I know it's just one play, but you look at the bomb to Chase and that's too high coverage. You know, it's quarters or cover four or something like that. And he releases inside of Stevens, who's got outside leverage, and he literally runs right by Marcus Williams. Mm-hmm. So it's like, okay, we did have and I think Ardarius was the other safety on the other side. So we got two safeties back. This guy just ran by both of them. So
well, first of all, you see Ardarius Washington coming from the other side of the field. And just because he comes into your picture at the end of that, if you're looking at the All-22, you know, literally the All-22, because that's the end zone view of the coach's view. If you look at that, you'll see Ardarius Washington has no business even being close to that play. He's not.
No, it's not his play.
It's not his play. It's Williams' play. Williams committed to an underneath route, which I'm not sure why. There was somebody on the sideline, I didn't even catch his number, who he went towards. But leaving Stevens on Chase is just it's a brain fart in terms of what had happened in the game already at that point. It's like if they're not having the discussion that you'd have about, you know, a goal scorer in soccer or a post-up player and saying, you know, he's going to be double teamed every single play. We're not going to let him go unmarked ever, you know, and get in the box if he's a striker or whatever. I mean, just I would think you're at this point with Jamar Chase where you have to say we need to find a way to cover him no matter what. And you know, Williams picking another option at that point, just it's boggles the mind.
Yeah, that's something. That's one of those examples where I talked about it earlier, maybe in part one, about how a safety can undress a corner, where he's counting on having help inside on that vertical route. That's why he's playing it the way that he's playing it. Because, all right, if he releases inside and continues to go vertical on me, I've got a safety inside who can help me bracket that route. And when that doesn't happen, you can look at the corner and be like, oh, what the hell is this guy doing? But it's like, no, I'm the way we're supposed to play this. I'm supposed to have help inside there on this vertical route. And now it's gone. But something that I know I've not had a lot of answers to these questions about the defense, but the one thing that I do think is an answer, and I've seen it in years past, and I think you're just seeing a different variation of it this year again. When, not just their defense, I guess it's be true of all defenses. When defenses struggle, you start to see guys press. Even experienced guys, even veteran guys who know the defense and know, you know, how to play certain things, you start to see them press. You start to see them try to do too much, try to do things that are not their job. You see this happen repeatedly in this secondary. Mm-hmm. Two guys going to the flat, two guys going here, two guys going there, and completely vacating another area. It's because somebody is thinking, hey, I got to go make that play. Right. We haven't been making that play. We've been getting beat. I'm the one that's going to turn this thing around. Or either I don't trust the other guy I'm playing with to make that play because he's had some mistakes. I'm going to go make that play. And that just has a domino effect, a negative domino effect in defense, because if you're getting out of position, now that's vacating another area. It's also putting stress on other people in coverage, because now they're like, well, wait a minute, you're supposed to be there. Now I got to get over there. Now I'm vacating my area too. So it just has this domino effect. And that's one thing I think I do see consistently not just with this defense, but with probably any defense that's struggling. You start to press, you start to try to do too much. And instead of it having the effect that you would hope it would have, like, oh, I'm going to try harder, I'm going to do extra, I'm going to make plays. No, you used to say this about Patrick Queen all the time. If you just do your job, the plays will come to you. You'll make plenty of plays because that's the design of the defense. But if you're trying to do everybody else's job except yours, it's not going to work.
Yeah. I'm going to add one thing to what you said, because I think that's golden advice, period, of in terms of individual players just trusting the system. But there's something else to it. And I've got to get my head together here, because I've just forgotten what my train of thought was. This is always embarrassing when it happens. This is terrible. Let me see. It might have been in the next question. They said no. Okay. Oh, no. I know what I want to say. Okay. All offensive coordinators are trying to force a particular safety or a particular coverage area into dilemmas, not problems, not things that they can solve, into two choices where they can make one. They're trying to give them a dilemma where you can't cover both of two players. So when you see this, and Marcus Williams is put in that kind of a spot, the player could do one of two things usually, and one is only successful in the case that it creates a little bit of fear, and that's to kind of play in between the two targets and convince the quarterback that you can go to either. Okay. And the second one is to bail out and take one target and do the best you can to cover that, and hopefully, and that's the play at 100 miles an hour and see if it works out method, which for some players, that's the best advice you can give them. Yeah. But I do think that Marcus Williams in that particular case was overly concerned about the underneath receiver by the sideline, where if that throw gets made, it's probably going to be caught and this guy's going to turn to make the catch and go out of bounds right away. So it's going to be a much less severe situation than any ball that's completed to Chase when he's got Stevens already trailing him in the route. I think it was a bad individual choice of two on that play, and it's bad to see. But anyway, offensive coordinators are trying to do that to you.
Yeah, that guy's, to your point, that guy's either going to go out of bounds or it's a catch and tackle situation.
Right.
And we're lining up to play the next play. What we're not doing when you make the choice he made is that we're not lining up to play the next play. We're going to the bench because he just scored. So Denard would tell me, Denard Melton, again, co-host mm-hmm. Fire Zone Show, would tell me all the time, we can live with lining up to play the next play. Right. We can live with that as a defense. Obviously, you want to stop plays, but if we get a chance to line up and play another play, you never know what can happen on that next play. But when we can't do that, when we got to go sit down on the bench and listen to the band play, not our band, but the opposing band play, because the guy just scored a touchdown, that's a non-starter. Right. We can't go anywhere from there. So, yeah, if you and this is something I talk about all the time with those slant flat combinations. Right. You see two receivers on the side, one guy runs a slant, one guy runs a flat, and you'll see a linebacker inside, right? And he wants to drive on that flat immediately, right? And kind of open up the slant window. Corner's got outside leverage, receiver's got inside leverage, linebacker runs out of there, and now you got an open window on the slant. The best corners can close that cushion and still make a play on that ball. Mm-hmm. The guys who are not the best corners, they need that help. So one thing that I've heard some coaches say, and I like that they teach it this way, is hold, if you're that inside player, whether you're a linebacker, safety, whoever you are, hold in that slant window as long as you can. Make the quarterback pull you to the flat with a throw, because then that's a catch and tackle situation, right? Mm-hmm. But when you open up that slant window, that cornerback, if he's playing with outside leverage and he's expecting that, hey, I'm going to have a little bit of help in there, at least to give me some time to get on that throw, and you undress him that way, those are easy all day long. I think we saw that with a throw to Yoshibas. It was maybe first quarter down in the red zone area. There was no way that Brandon Simmons was going to make that play. He's not that level of individual corner, number one. But if Simpson flies out of there to cover the flat, he's got no chance. So I don't know, man. There's little things like that all over their film where it's just like little detail, kind of attention to detail, nuanced things where you're like, maybe if we're a little bit more dialed in on some of those things, yeah, we're still giving up yardage, but we're not giving up these big chunk yardage plays and touchdowns.
All right. Outstanding stuff. I want to mention three other people. Haas Bonaventure, I think we covered this question. He talked about acquiring Marcus Lattimore, why they might have wanted him. It might have been a case of moving Stevens to safety. We talked a little bit about moving Stevens to safety. In part one, we did. We think we've hit it a little bit in this one. Appreciate the question. Ravens 615, can the defense be fixed by January? We got some different views on that, I think. I would say that what's nice about this is at least for 2025, that the Ravens have a set of problems that I think they're going to be able to do some replace a very below average player with a very good player potentially. So they have, you know, whether that means, you know, really emphasizing the draft at a particular position or whatever it might be, it does make it easier when you have a few giant holes and not a bunch of very average players. Having a bunch of very average players is an absolute curse in terms of what you got. It's hard to change that. Sour, not salty. When Kyle Hamilton comes back, do you think that Zach will be forced to move him to a deep safety / center field role? Very good question. I think it's possible.
Yeah, I don't think he'll be forced to. I think this is something I've thought about since they drafted Hamilton. And I think those first couple games, his rookie year, he did play more deep safety than he played nickel. And I want to say right around midseason, might have been that Saints game.
Yep, midseason.
Right around the time when they drafted Rowe, they started to play more at nickel. Now, I think some of that might have been for him because early in the season, and Kyle admitted this himself, that somebody asked him, was the game moving too fast? He said, no, it's my mind. My mind's moving too fast right now. And I think what they tried to do to help him was let's get him in one role. Let's get him in one set of responsibilities. Let him really focus in on those things and get comfortable. And he started to get really comfortable with it. And then he took the next step and started to make plays. And I think you've talked about it before. And this is what it kind of, you know, swung me to this school of thought too. He's so good at nickel and up close to the line of scrimmage. He makes so many plays. He impacts so many things. You can't throw perimeter screens. That's gone. Take that out of the playbook. Take it out.
He takes the strong side of the football field away. And there's no other horizontal defender like him in the NFL.
No, take it out. So does that mean never play him on the back end? No. And they do that now. Or you know, when he was healthy. Yeah, he'll take some snaps on the back end. But I think that you lose a lot of what makes him the great player that he is if you only have him play on the back end. Because you know what offenses can do. It's okay, you want to go back there, you want to drop 15, 20 yards deep. All right, fine, cool. You're taking something away there. We'll just go underneath. You can just go back there and do cardio, buddy, and we'll never throw the ball your way. So I'm not a huge fan of that.
I'm also a fan in getting the most out of Hamilton. I think you have to not let the cart drag the horse in terms of where you're thinking. Your superstar players, their positioning and where they can make the biggest impact has got to drive how you want to organize your defense. And Hamilton is, just because he's an ultimate wild card, he's the ace of spades at the slot corner position, as we've seen. And he's the king of diamonds when he plays dime, probably. And he's a jack of hearts if you move him back to the back end, which is still a good card.
Good card.
But, you know, is not as valuable as he can be other places. And you really have to be forced into that before you make it happen. But I do think the Ravens are in and all options are on the table kind of moment right now with a team that's otherwise prepared to win. Now, and it's not an irreversible move either, which is one of the things I like about it. Maybe it even improves Kyle's ability to play up front a little bit, play a few games on the back end, get reacquainted with, you know, what's going on behind him and whatnot. It's just a thought anyway.
Yeah, sure.
All right. We've got a few more questions. We'll leave them for the end. Let's talk about individual players. Who would you like to talk about?
I think I'll start out with Kyle Van Noy. Obviously, he was on a real heater earlier this season in terms of sacks. You know, those numbers have cooled a little bit. But when I think about his effect in this game, particularly when they started running those pick games, he's the inside guy a lot of times and opening up, you know, a looper looping outside and then sometimes continuing to get pressure himself, even on that inside path. I think it was kind of an unsung thing. Because he didn't have I don't think he had a sack in this game. I don't know if they gave him credit for a half or if he split it.
I'll give you how I scored it. He had one quarterback hit, and that's not in dispute. And then the pressure is going to differ by who gives a score. But I had him for six full pressures and two half pressures.
Yeah, so I think he was the setup guy a lot in this game and a lot of those pass rushing situations. And that is something that is not always going to be captured in terms of a sack. I guess pressure can do a good job of.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are now boarding Group A. Please have your boarding passes ready to scan. If your phone is cracked, old, or was chewed up by your Chihuahua travel companion, please refrain from holding up the line. And instead, simply go to Verizon and trade in any phone in any condition from one of their top brands for the new Samsung Galaxy S25 Plus with Galaxy AI on Unlimited Ultimate and Watch or Tap, also on them. Service plan required for Watch or Tap. Trade-in and additional terms apply. See Verizon.com for details.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Of capturing it, but it can just set up other guys. It can force the quarterback to move off of his spot, which, mm-hmm. you know, ideally defensively is something that you want to try to do, but you also don't want to let the quarterback get out. So that's kind of the gift and the curse of that is you want to get them off the spot, but then they get out. And obviously we saw what Burrow can do when he gets out. So that's a tough thing, but I still really liked what he brought in that role as kind of the setup guy in this game instead of maybe the guy who's going to be the finisher as much as he was kind of earlier in the season. I'm going to set up some other guys. It's going to help the overall pressure as a unit. And, you know, I'm always drawn to kind of the dirty work and the things that, you know, maybe don't always get recognized.
Love Kyle Van Noy and everything he's brought to the Ravens. And he's, I kind of wish he'd be a more obviously vocal leader because I think he clearly has those leadership qualities. He's a great communicator. He does stand-up comedy during the offseason. I mean, there's a lot of things that make Kyle Van Noy a great leadership candidate. But one of the things he said when I asked him a question this summer is, I was talking about Joe Evans, who was out there for a huge number of snaps in one of the preseason games, having a difficult time. And I go, you know, is there anything you go over to say and encourage that guy? And he said, I wait to be talked to because, you know, the last thing I want to do is go to a guy as everybody in his head already, including coaches probably, and try and do something. Hey, have you tried this kind of thing? Yeah. He actually was being funny as he said it because he thought the idea was, you know, kind of silly that he would do this. But I think there is something to accountability that he's outstanding at receiving accountability, even from a very young player. I've seen him take it from Simpson directly. Simpson comes over to him screaming about not covering a running back in the flak. He immediately, his back was turned, but you could just tell from his body language, he basically said, my bad, you know, and Simpson immediately shut up, a perfect exchange, exactly what you want. I want that guy on the other end of that accountability discussion too, telling somebody else you didn't do that right. I want him occasionally to feel good about going to somebody else and saying, hey, look, if we're going to play together, I need you to maintain outside leverage because I've got the inside side here, whatever it might be. I would love for Kyle Van Noy to be a more vocal leader. It might not be him or might not be who he wants to be. Yeah. But I've loved that about him. All right, let me pick another player here. I thought that Adafi Owe had a fantastic game in this one. Four quarterback hits officially, by the way. And I know people are going to remember the missed sack and slipping off that. But he also had two other quarterback hits that were lost to penalty. One was the roughing the passer by Washington. And the other was a defensive holding. No, it was defensive pass interference on Wiggins. Wiped out one of his two quarterback hits. So, you know, unbelievable day of knocking Burrow on the ground. It was just really sweet to see Burrow hit that hard in a game. I mean, I don't root for the other team's players to be injured specifically, but I think beating up the quarterback is an important path to victory in the NFL. You need to make the opposing quarterback hurt so that he doesn't have all his faculties available to throw the football effectively.
Yeah, you want to hit those guys as much as possible, as much as you can. And they really got after Joe Burrow in that regard. And that Washington hit, I know it got called for roughing, but that was a vicious hit.
Thing of beauty. Thing of beauty. The only hit that I've seen this year that was any harder was Travis Jones knocking down Josh Allen by that left sideline on the fumble.
Yeah, that was we talk about Deke Leader. That was
All right, who's your next guy?
Next guy, and you know, I think I could alternate these guys because we're probably going to talk about both of them. One of us would talk about both of them, but I'll go Marlon Humphrey right here. Obviously, he had that critical play. We talked about it with the fumble. Another great follow on Twitter if you're into defense is the Coach A. That's Cody Alexander. Written a bunch of books, Match Quarters. People may know him. He's got a Substack, I think, by the same name. Really good. If you like defensive football, but he always talks about rip the cord, right? It's like starting a lawnmower, right? And you see that when Marlon goes in there to rip that ball out of there. So he always talks about ripping the cord. And that was like a textbook example of how you rip the cord on that fumble on Chase Brown. And like you said, just a critical turning point in the game, because I think the Bengals were up 21-7 at that point.
That's right.
You're in the third quarter. They're back in their own territory, but they had just gotten a first down and then maybe ran like one other play. And then that's when, you know, he was able to force the fumble. So, and then from that point on, you know, it shifted, right? The game just shifted. And so, yeah, critical play. Think he had, you know, maybe, you know, another couple nice plays in coverage. There's at least one PBU I'm thinking of where he kind of drove on a ball, might've been against Chase and got a PBU. You know, had the face mask penalty on Yoshivas. That was kind of unfortunate. But one thing I think I would say about Marlon this year, and not to say that he hasn't always played this way, it's not what I mean by this, but it's just so noticeable this year. It's just his effort. Like, he's playing super hard, like super hard. I mean, sometimes you'll see it like chasing down plays from like the opposite side of the field, and he might not even be the one who ends up making the tackle, but he is hauling ass to get over there and make that tackle. And he said it was something he picked up from Roe in the offseason, where Roquan talked about how, you know, not that he's thinking about retirement now, but they were, whatever reason, just talking about retirement. He's like, you know, I'm not going to miss the game when I retire. This is what Roquan is telling Marlon. And he's like, because I'm going to give 100%. Like, I'm emptying the tank. There's not going to be anything left. So there'll be nothing for me to miss. I will have given everything when I'm out on the field. And it wasn't like he was necessarily challenging Marlon, but I think Marlon said he took it as a challenge. Like, I want to match that level of effort on every play. I want to match that level of energy. And I think it's noticeable this year when he's healthy, when Marlon's been healthy, which he's been more healthy this year than he has in a while. I think you see that effort. And you see similarly, not the effort part, but an urgency, like a similar urgency you see in Lamar. Like, yeah, this is fleeting. We got to go get this, okay? Because the sand and the hourglass, it's running. So we got to go get this.
That definitely was true at the start of the season or at the start of camp for Marlon Humphrey, because, you know, we're coming up into big contract years for a lot of players, but one of the two big choices would be, do you keep Marlon Humphrey or do you keep Mark Andrews? Might've been a real choice. They're both big contracts, similar points in terms of age. You got real questions about who you can keep. Now, I don't think there's any question they really are going to want to extend Marlon Humphrey. And I really liked an answer. I've got about four nice things to say about Marlon really quickly. I really liked an answer he gave me at camp, which was that he has not yet had discussions with coaches about moving to safety, but he always saw himself finishing his career at safety. And I think that's great. First of all, you know, there's just a realization that you can only play corner for so long in this league. You can only be so fast. Right now, Marlon Humphrey is playing at such a physical level. And this goes with some of the urgency and whatnot. He's a hard-hitting dude. He likes to rush the passer. He likes to play the run. He likes to get after it and tackle people. He doesn't like to miss tackles. Nobody really does. But then other people aren't really willing to sacrifice to make a tackle to the same degree that Marlon Humphrey is sometimes. And the other thing is, he is the best corner that I can remember since Jimmy Smith to wear a Ravens uniform in terms of making a play on the ball on somebody else's man, knowing when it's time, just abandon your own assignment, go to this other guy and make a play on the ball. That's led to four interceptions this year, most notably in the back corner of the end zone against Baker Mayfield. in the Tampa game. He has been absolutely the best player in camp by an enormous margin. It was not close. There were other contenders at certain times who were playing better for a while. Ardarius Washington finished very strong. Humphrey, by far the best player. I mean, in a certain way, they had to tell him to ratchet it down a little bit and let the offense, you know, run what they needed to do. Now they do have periods where the defense doesn't get to play really hard, but they had, you know, like walkthrough components where they're just learning the steps. But most of the rest of the time, Marlon Humphrey wants to knock down every ball. Yeah. And even when it's a non-physical practice, he wants to try and take it away. He's played at such a level this year. I'm very excited. I you know, it was last year, I was even a little concerned. He was becoming distracted by the social media stuff and his own kind of fame is not the right word, because he's extremely talented guy, no matter how you want to slice it. But I thought he was becoming a little bit distracted by the social media stuff relative to his play on the field.
Yeah, I think there were people that had a lot of concerns, particularly with, you know, he's doing his own podcast. But I think, you know, it's hard sometimes as fans to see that, okay, football is their job. Okay. It's their profession. And they get an off day from their profession, just like most people get an off day or sometimes two off days for their profession. And it's okay to do other things on that off day. And it's not going to take away from what you do at your job. But yep. I think that's sometimes hard for fans to separate, because they're like, well, no, it's just, he's not concentrated. He's not locked in. You got to be, you know, and it's something that in other industries, we probably wouldn't necessarily think about it that way. Like, you know, I'll use my job, for example, right? And just keep it general. I just work for the federal government, but I'm an analyst. And if I'm off on a Saturday or Sunday, there's not anybody who I work with or people who know that I'm asking, say, oh, Mike, you need to be getting in that acquisition regulation. What are you doing, man? What are you doing out here sitting on your chair having a beer? You need to be getting in that thing. I think people outside of sports seem to understand when you're off, it's okay to do other things. It's okay to have other interests. But for whatever reason, maybe it's the money. Money's probably a factor with sports. It's like, no. If you're not all football all the time, then you're not locked in. And I think some guys, that could become true. There could be some guys who go so far to the end of that spectrum where they kind of maybe are starting to get like 1 foot outside of the game. And they're kind of thinking about, okay, what am I going to be doing after I'm done playing? So I'm not saying it never happens, but I think sometimes people get that rep. And it's funny to watch that play out, because you'll see people tweet stuff to him specifically. Oh, you need to get off the podcast. You need to stop doing this. You stop need doing that. And then he'll have a game where he'll have a big turnover, a big interception. Oh, great play, Margaret. It's like, well, wait a minute. I thought the podcast was hurting him. I thought that's why he wasn't making any plays.
Well, you can't take the voice away from the fans either, because they're going to be irrational to the degree.
That's what makes you a fan.
Yes. I love Marlon. It is just one of these things. You see certain personal characteristics occasionally with people that you cannot reconcile with being a great football player, because they don't match up. And some of the bullshit that Johnny Manziel used to do exactly fits into that.
Yeah.
So if you're in Las Vegas on Saturday before a Sunday football game, and then you don't get home in time to be there to play in that game, I mean, I don't have any tolerance for you. I mean,
no, that's the extreme end of the spectrum. Yeah. Like, Saturday is not your off day. That's a work day. So you're supposed to be working.
That is the reason why they effectively lock up the players in the hotel the night before the game. I mean, it's, I don't mean it to sound like a prison camp or anything, but they need to make sure that all the cats are in a pen to be, so that they're easy to herd, because you have 53 young men with 53 different ideas, or okay, it's by 27 different ideas about what they want to do. That's still a lot of places where something can go wrong. And that certainly has happened at certain times in the Ravens past, even with some players who I don't even need to name. Yeah. because it ended up that way. But anyway, let's move on. Let's talk about Nnamdi Madubuike and the game he had. Wonderful comeback with Travis Jones there. So it's kind of like we're talking about both of them at the same time. Travis and he are a pairing. They played almost every snap together. I think he, uh, Travis played 50 and Matabike played 56, but every Travis Jones snap was a Matabike snap. So they're intentionally trying to get that pairing out there on passing downs. Very effective of making, we talked about this a little bit in the first show about making sure that Travis is creating single opportunities for Matabike. And they move him around. You can do that with Chris Jones and move him around all over the place to try and get your singles. Or you can have a dominant interior lineman to go with him that commands a double regardless. And it makes everyone better. The Ravens have missed him so much for the last three games in Jones. And Matabike has just, you know, he was reborn in this last game in terms of, I thought one of the things I liked even more sometimes than just the initial pressure he's getting, which is awfully valuable, is some of the pursuit we saw from him, going after Burrow to the left sideline and knocking the ball free. It had all the elements to it. We saw Owe miss a chance to knock the ball free from Burrow. He got a quarterback hit, which, hey, it's always nice to put the quarterback on the ground, but I don't know about you. I kind of want the football.
Yeah. Get the ball out, get the ball out. Right. That is always, the goal, I think, or should be always the goal. And there was a guy, who was his pass rusher? Was it Simeon Rice? Might've been Simeon Rice. It's something he would always talk about. Now he had a bunch of sacks too, but I think he would always talk about, like, I'm going for the ball, right? If I get a sack as I'm going for the ball, hey, great, right? Sacks get you paid, but I'm going for the ball every single time, right? Different position, but Marcus Peters would talk about that all the time. I want the ball.
Right.
I want to take the ball away. Is that going to maybe expose me at times in some other ways? Yeah, probably. But I want the ball.
He's one of the greatest gamblers who've ever played on the back end of an NFL defense. And I'll tell you, with Marcus Peters, you don't got to be right very often to mm-hmm. make that the right gamble. It's almost always is the right choice. So especially when you're a threat to go for a pick six every time you drive on the football, it's really not a tough decision. Would you like to talk MVPs 3-2-1 before you, or anybody else that we've missed on the individuals that we should be talking about? So,
nobody that I can think of.
How about Nate Wiggins?
Okay. Yeah. We can talk about Nate. Look, Nate's got all the talent in the world. I mean, that's why he was picked in the first round. Mm-hmm. I think you can see that, he's getting more and more comfortable. Yeah, he got that pass interference call. I guess it was against Chase. I mean, I like that kind of coverage, to be honest with you. I like that kind of physicality at the top of a route, right? Chase is releasing. And those are always some of the hardest routes, I think, for a DB when they're one-on-one, is guy releases inside but then breaks back outside, right? Mm-hmm. I think that's always tough because he's got to fight across your body now. Once he goes inside, you're inside, and now he's got to fight, or you might be on his outside shoulder because he's gone inside. Now you got to fight across, he's got to fight across your body to get back outside. So there's going to be a level of physicality involved with that because he literally has to get across your body to get back outside. Refs thought it was a little too much. There are probably some things coaches will coach him up on and say, there's some technique things you can do here to still be physical with it, but not get called for a flag, in terms of maybe his hand placement or something like that. But I like to see that part of his game growing. We know he's got all the athletic ability. He's got the speed. He's twitchy. I think he's instinctive, ball skills. But that physicality component, look, you don't have to turn into, like the most physical guy in the world out there at corner. But if you can just kind of add that to your game when you have all of those other things that he has, I think it's going to bode well. And I think he's going to be really good. I think, there's been some ups and downs this year. It's his rookie year. I get all of that. That's part of the process. But I think he's going to be really good. I think he's got all the talent in the world.
I mean, I do too. He's on a great run right now. And I think maybe some people don't realize just how well he's playing recently, but he's had the last three games. Let me put this together here. He's been targeted 12 times in the last three games and given up 16 total yards on those plays.
It's pretty good.
That ain't bad. 1.33 yards per target there. And there have been some penalties. I think the trend line is up for him this year. I would like them try, if they're going to gamble somewhere in the secondary and try and make this unit better, I think you start off by trying to increase Nate Wiggins' role. And if that means a few less snaps for Stevens, that's fine. If it means that would be the lowest possible volume I would want to turn it up to. If you want to go to the highest possible volume, I'm having Wiggins chase number one receivers who give you trouble. because I think he's a guy who I'm actually more comfortable having Marlon on a number two on an island and try to take it away that way. And Wiggins with help, I think it would be extraordinarily useful against number ones. And I think I'm in favor of that. I'm dialing it all the way up to 11 right now on where I want Wiggins involved in this defense as a central figure.
Yeah, back to the all options on the table mantra. If you're like, look, man, we got to try something here, and we understand it's putting a lot on your plate as a first year player, but we wouldn't have picked you if we didn't think you could handle it. So we may see that in the coming weeks where they just say, hey, look, we're giving you the keys and go out there and play.
Yeah. All right. Michael, do you want to do a 3-2-1 MVPs with me in this game?
It's probably going to be a lot of duplicates for me. These guys that I already talked about are probably going to be the MVPs, but sure, we can do it.
All right. Well, give me your number three guy. Then you get to say first and I get to be the copycat.
All right. Shocker. It's going to be Kyle Van Noy for me in number three.
No, great choice. He's one of the guys I think played very well in this game. And no question about it. We talked about him off. I don't think we have to. My number three guy is Marlon Humphrey. Had the big play of the game, targeted 10 times in the game. Wasn't bad. It was about 5 and change yards per target. So it was fine in that case. Did have a penalty. The face mask was unfortunate. Seems like the Ravens have had a lot of defensive drive extending penalties this year. But he generally has not been the problem. He has generally been the guy who's ended a few drives with turnovers and with other good plays on third down.
He was going to be my number two guy. So that makes this very easy.
All right. So I'll just jump in and say, anything else to say about him?
No, I think we've covered it.
All right. My number two guy is Travis Jones. And I think a lot of it is what he did for other people when he came back. It's just a night and day pass rush with him, without him. And he personally had a great, great pass rush game. And I do not fault him for the missed call on the roughing the passer on the 2-point play at all. It's not anything that'll go in the books as a quarterback hit for him, but it was probably as important as just about any play in this game for the Baltimore Ravens, other than the Humphrey turnover. It was just a game sealing play, frankly, all by itself. And Ardarius Washington, had the other half of it, I guess, on the other end, but that ball was overthrown because he laid a bodacious hit on Burrow.
Yep, he sure did.
All right.
So number one guy. Might be your number one guy, Nnamdi Madubuike. So I know we've talked about him a bunch already. That's why I'm not saying anything more. I think we've said everything we could say about him in terms of the positive impact he had in this game as a pass rusher. Still makes his presence felt in the run game too. So what can you say? It was just one of those games where obviously it was a huge game. A lot at stake, and you need your best players to play their best in those games. And he turned it up. I mean, he turned the dial all the way up to 10 in this game and showed up and showed out. And that's what you expect for your best players in these types of games.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I'll ask you one question about Nnamdi since we're on him here. Are you at all concerned about the amount of snaps he's playing right now and a potential reduction in effectiveness due to it?
It's a good question, because I think I saw somebody ask this on Twitter, like if the amount of snaps that he and Travis Jones played last night was because of the magnitude of the game, or was somewhat near, what their average amount of snaps are. I don't know that. You may.
Sure.
But yeah, I think it's something you always are concerned about. How many times have we heard Harbaugh say this year, it's a long season, right? We've heard him say that a bunch of times. It's a long season. And so, yeah, I think, where you can, you'd like to kind of borrow an NBA term, you'd like to do some load management with these guys, to take some of these snaps off of them. That's why I think it was pretty interesting. You probably saw this report. In addition to the Lattimore, potential deal, there was also a potential deal with Calais to bring Calais Campbell back.
I would have been excited about that.
Yeah, that would have been right. I mean, you can talk about his age or whatever, but Calais, he's found a way to defy Father Time and still be effective even at his age. So I don't know how he does it, but he does it. But you know, that would have been nice too, in terms of being able to give those guys, you know, a little bit more of a break sometime. So yeah, I'm a little concerned about it because they're your two best interior guys. And you need them out there on the field. So yeah, I'm a little worried, but outside of them, you know, getting big leads and being able to rotate some other guys in there, I'm not really sure what else you can do about it. You need those guys out there.
You know, Calais, okay. First of all, this game, part of the problem was just that Cincinnati played 75 offensive snaps. So when you start with that, you're going to play your best players. And then the second part of it is 4 freaking IDL again, you know, I on the roster for the game. I will continue my very loud disappointment with not shucking a special teams player to the curb and, you know, adding a Wormley or whatever, even if it's just for insurance, you know, and adding a Wormley. They've only got one guy they can really bring up at this point. It's Wormley.
Wormley.
After that, you know, you're talking about a Chris Ravenel or somebody was, I believe, is the only other guy even on the practice squad. So, you know, just having that one extra guy who can play some defensive line snaps would mean a lot. And after the you know, the torture they've been through these last few weeks, particularly in the Tampa game, and then, you know, again against the Browns, really, really just don't like the idea at all of being a lineman short. It's just that's a 8 or a 9 or a 10 risk to be a defensive lineman short, and it's a 1 or a 2 risk to be a special teams player short. And yeah, there are a few special team snaps. You have to cover kicks. You have to return kicks. You have to return punts. You have to cover cunts. All those things, I mean, they don't add up to the wear that goes on the defensive line if you're a man short there. It's very bad.
It has been kind of interesting, particularly since Urban and Pierce have been out with injuries, that they wouldn't have at least one other interior D lineman up in these games consistently. I mean, I guess Wormley and Tuupo, I can never pronounce that correctly, played in the Broncos game. I guess only Tuupo played in this game. But yeah, it's a little interesting that they haven't done that more. And maybe it's also the managing of the elevations. You know, I don't know, but it's been kind of interesting.
Yeah. Oh, you're saying because they only get 3 with Wormley that they want to conserve them. I mean, that could be. Then you need another lineman. There's degradation as you go on. There's attrition in that level. Hopefully, I mean, really, Brent Urban is very key to come back because he's a guy who has played a lot of snaps in the past and could play a lot if they really needed him to, I believe, still. All right. Michael, I can't tell you how much fun it's been. It's been the last 2 hours and 20 minutes talking football with you. I look forward to this as often as we get a chance to do it. Please tell folks where they can find your stuff online or talk to you maybe on Twitter.
Yeah, so probably Twitter's the best place these days, at Abukari, A-B-U-K-A-R-I. I'm always going to shout out Chris Aguilera, Kerry Stevenson, and Denard Melton. Yeah, Deep Cover and Fire Zone Show, we're not, you know, putting out shows as frequently as we once were, but, you know, keep your eyes and ears open. Some stuff may pop out every now and then, but they're just great, great guys to do this kind of stuff with. Better people aside from any of the football stuff. So, you know, I'm always going to talk about those guys when I get a chance, but yeah, that's pretty much where you can find me and where you can find those guys. And you know, who knows, maybe we'll have a show come out soon.
All right. I will tell you, Denard's been on the show recently. I really respect his opinion. It's always great to have him on to talk defense as an ex-linebacker and what he brings to that. But Chris Aguilera is someone who did the offensive tackle show before the draft. And he was very high on Roger Rosengarten relative to some other guys. Like Suamataia was probably my guy over Rosengarten. And, you know, I'd have to say so far it looks like it's neither has been perfect, but I think that you know, the Ravens probably did a pretty good job of getting Rosengarten at this point. You can't become wedded to any position on a draft player that you like. That's really important.
Yeah,
that you can constantly reevaluate yourself and reevaluate, you know, how did you get something wrong, or why was this the guy, or is it just a matter of circumstance, you know, perhaps in a particular player. But in the case of Chris, he really liked Rosengarten. I respect that. Haven't had the chance to do a show with Kerry Stevenson, but I really want to. And Kerry, if you're out there, please contact me. about that. Because for whatever reason, I can't find your Twitter handle. And I'll ask Michael after the show. But Michael, thanks for doing this. Always great. If you're fans of the show, there's two things we'd ask you to do. If you can write a 50-word five-star review, always happy for that. Even more important, share this show with somebody else who maybe doesn't know about it yet. You're an older person who doesn't use podcast is always my number one go-to guy, is to show him how to play it directly off his laptop or his desktop. And so he can be introduced to the show there and hopefully enjoy the content and move along. Michael, thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me on, Ken. It's always great. I know you said 2 hours and 20 minutes, but it flies by. It never feels that long.
Yep. Yeah, for me too as well, my friend. And we'll talk to you next time on Film Study.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are now boarding Group A. Please have your boarding passes ready to scan. If your phone is cracked, old, or was chewed up by your Chihuahua travel companion, please refrain from holding up the line. And instead, simply go to Verizon and trade in any phone in any condition from one of their top brands for the new Samsung Galaxy S25 Plus with Galaxy AI on Unlimited Ultimate and a watch or tab. Also, on them.
Service plan required for watch or tab. Trade-in and additional terms apply. See Verizon.com for details.
Access big savings every day, all in the Kroger app.
Get tender Heritage Farm boneless chicken breast for $2.49 a pound. Then find low prices on thousands of items like sparkling ice water, Kroger brand chips, and more, all with your card.
Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.